So the talk for this evening, again, somebody asked me a question, and this one was an interesting question, which I know nothing about, as usual. And they asked me, can you please give a talk on monogamy? And I thought, wow, that's an interesting talk. So a lot of times people think that means the difference between monogamy and polygamy. But there's the other third option, the solitude. And that's I'm also going to introduce there. But first of all, this is for Buddhism. We don't tell you what to do as much as we advise you how to do it. So we don't have all these great rules and laws about whether you can have same-sex marriage or one-sex marriage or whatever else which goes along. But as long as you do it well, it's how you do things makes it good, makes it worthwhile. Not sort of so much of what you do, it's how you do things. So if you are going to commit to a person, it's how you do that. If you are going to stay single, it's how you do that. If you are going to have many partners, in fact, I know many people here who are polygamous, I know quite a few people who've had a couple of wives, but, not at the same time, just, one after the other. But it has them at the same time. There's obviously the problem sex. It makes it really, really difficult to manage. I know that some women have a lot of great difficulty just juggling their career, their children, their husband. Imagine having two husbands to juggle, three husbands to juggle. That would be very difficult. So women are usually pretty wise. They only just have one husband or no husbands. Guys, on the other hand, sometimes they think of like maybe have two wives or three wives or four wives. But in some cultures they allow that. I can't get my head around that myself. Personally, that it just because human beings, the nature of human beings is jealousy, this competition, and you have to have only in societies where there's strong hierarchies, where the guy is really the boss and can keep all of the people in order. Only then can it really sort of work out. It's hard enough for me having so many nuns, but they're just nuns. If they have them wives, that'd drive me absolutely crazy. So. To look after, but they're all good nuns. But when we have the idea of many, many partners all at the same time, it's really, to me, it's asking for trouble. Now, why do you have a partner in the first place? You want some emotional support. I know, as Dennis is in the back there, we do marriages together. He does the civil part, I do the spiritual side of it. But he always says that marriage or relationships is a mystery. And being a scientist, any mystery, I'm really into finding out what is really underneath all that mystery. Whether it's ghosts, always finding out what's underneath the ghosts. Why are they there? And as a scientist, find out what is this, world in which we live. Not a mystery, but understanding it more. And so a relationship, what actually is that? Why do people commit together? Obviously, there's a lot of chemistry there as well. It literally does mean chemistry, because a lot of times when a person, a boy and girl, meets, the beginnings of their relationship, it's actually there's a chemical interaction between the two of you. Kissing, hugging, being close to each other, the smells, the touch. It is very much the case. You don't love him. You don't love her. You love the way that he or she makes you feel. And in their presence, you get a high, a boost. That is the beginning of the physical type of love, the sort of mutual interaction of pleasure, which is, you're in this world, so I know exactly what you're doing. That's the beginning of the relationships. But if you have a really strong relationship, you go past so much the physical part of it, and you go to the deeper part of a relationship, which is a much more experiencing each other, as a couple, getting the emotional understanding of what it's like to live with another person. Sometimes I wonder, the mystery to me was, why is it that when people do get married, they get a priest or a monk to be part of the service? And if you think about it, what does a priest or a monk know about marriage? They're usually celibate. But the reason why that people get people of religion to come into the marriage is because there is something spiritual about it. And I often wonder, what actually is it when you commit to another partner another person, you are doing a lot of letting go. You're letting go of what you want, how you want to do it. Letting go of a lot of your personal freedom when you commit to another person. And I always thought that letting go of what you want to do, letting go of your sense of controlling your whole life when you commit to another person, is one of the important parts of the spirituality of a marriage. Because the love which you experience is far greater and far more powerful than almost anything you've ever experienced before when you fall in love with somebody. And it is really sort of consuming. And the love is more important at the beginning with getting your own way. The hierarchy changes. Love is more important. Unfortunately, that during the relationship, sometimes that hierarchy of love changes. And other things become more important than your commitment together. And that is a time when the love needs to be reactivated. The purpose of a marriage or a relationship needs to be refounded. Get it going again. Why are you two together? And of course, when that happens in that part of a life, we realize that just this being together, letting go of what I want to do, letting go of course of being right. You don't always have to be right. But being in love is more important than being right. And all these arguments which happen, I told you last time about that way of overcoming arguments by on the odd days of the month, she's right, even days, he's right. Therefore, you know, you share who's being right, and no one has to decide by argument who's right and who's wrong. The calendar decides. But all that idea of being right, it is something which really blocks the peace of a marriage. And it reminds me of that old Buddhist story. And when I first heard this Buddhist story, I realized, no, you have to go further than the original Buddhist story. And that was the story of the two monks arguing. There was a flag fluttering in the wind. And one monk said, the wind is moving. And the other one said, no, the flag is moving. And they argued, who's right, who's wrong. So they went to see the Zen monk, the master, and he said, you're both wrong. It wasn't the flag which was moving. It wasn't the wind which was moving. Your minds were moving. And I thought, no, that's not good enough. Because they'd argue with that. And so afterwards, the three of them, they went to see the forest monk, the Ajahn. And they said, first monk said the flag was moving. The second monk said, the wind was moving. And the master said, the mind was moving. What do you think, monk? And the monk replied, the problem was, your mouths were moving. Now that's a solution. Because when your mouths move, that's what destroys a marriage. Honestly, because I still remember this couple. I don't know where they've gone now, but years ago, I saw them here. It was an Australian guy married to a Thai girl. Never forget these two. And they'd already been married for a long time when I met them. And I asked the Thai girl, you know, in Thai, I can speak Thai. I said, do you know any English? She said, no, I don't know any English at all. I don't know Thai language. I said, what about your husband? He only knows English. He doesn't know any Thai. That's why they're so happy together. So if you do marry someone from a different culture, don't learn their language. And don't get them to learn English. And then you'll be happy when you don't understand what they're saying. Just smile. Because sometimes when you can't understand what the other person is saying, you don't know who's right and who's wrong. Instead, you can go on to the emotional level. Of just, you know, being friends together, being kind together, enjoying each other's company, instead of always arguing together. I always thought that the words, the thoughts, when the mouth moves, that's what causes all the trouble. And I don't know why I wrote in a book that we're supposed to have, you know, in Australia and in many other Western democracies, free speech. I think that's one of the big problems. I think speech should be taxed. I'm going to mention this to the treasurer, Joe Hockey. You can have a lot of income here. So every time you speak, you know, you have to pay a dollar. And that would actually save many marriages. And of course, the people who have to pay the most, the ones who speak the most, are the politicians themselves. And so when they have to pay so much, you know, to argue and speak, then they wouldn't actually speak so much. And they wouldn't argue so much. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could find some way of stopping people speaking so much? So my suggestion is a tax on speech. $1 a sentence. Well, actually, we did that. We tried that once. Years and years ago, I was reminded that I went on a pilgrimage to the holy sites of India. I think Elaine, you were there with me at the time, I think, on that pilgrimage. And when we first got on the bus, going into India on pilgrimage, this was some years ago, the roads were terrible. You know, any time you needed to go to the toilet, you had to get out of the bus and go behind a bush for number ones and number twos. It didn't really matter. There was no toilets around. It was hard, it was hot, it was dusty. And of course, usually, people in that situation, you complain. But the organizer had this wonderful little idea. The very first day, she put a box on the front of the bus, the complaints box. Now, there wasn't to write your complaint and put it in the box. It was every time you complain, you had to put $10 into the box. And every time, once we get to a place like an orphanage or something, we give it as a donation to an orphanage. And that was a wonderful way of stopping complaints when you had to pay for it. But this one guy, he's always complaining, he came up there and he put $50 in advance. So, that was worth it. That was all for charity, so it's all very good. If we can keep calm and quiet, if you could stop speaking so much, both of you, marriages would last much longer, because instead of listening to words, we're actually feeling much more. And this is one of the important things, that after a while in a marriage, you know, remember that the love is more important than sort of the words. And I've seen sometimes people are like that, that after a time they hardly speak to each other. Not they've had an argument or another. They know each other so well, they can feel each other so well, they know what each other wants. And they go, you know, through their house, through their day, perfectly content and at peace, but reasonably silent. It's very beautiful. So eventually, you know, we get this sort of love business coming up, and the relationship changes from the chemical stuff to something which is more like the word we have in Buddhism, Kalyanamitta, the beautiful good friends. Now, you've been through stuff together, you know, you've done so much together, you become like literally the best friends of each other, because you have to live close together and you learn much about each other. And that learning about each other, you know, with the feedback coming from a partner, that is actually a great bit of a spiritual growth. That's the other reason why the marriage can be a spiritual thing, because you have to, number one, you can't do what you really want to do. You have to do it for some higher goal, which is, you know, the marriage or the family. And number two is actually you have to start, instead of thinking so much, feeling more. I often say to people that it's the thoughts and the speech which cause all the problems. We actually feel rather than think so much, and the feelings are always far more accurate than the thoughts and the philosophies. Philosophers argue with each other, but, you know, great sort of spiritual leaders are kind to one another, and they can overcome all arguments just with a beautiful smile or a hug or doing some sort of kind act. But anyway, so we get together like that and we live a long life. But the problem with any relationship is, of course, the basic Buddhist teachings, it does not last. From the very beginning, you know, it has a use-by date. And the profound little saying, years ago I mentioned this, I haven't said this for so many years, it just came up just as I was meditating. Having a relationship, a marriage, is like going on a ship together, sailing out into the ocean, knowing the boat is going to sink at sea. That's what's going to happen. That's the truth of it. It's not going to survive forever. But you do that because it's worth doing. Sailing out together, knowing the boat's going to sink. Welcome to relationships. Sometimes they sink early, sometimes they sink late. And of course, you, as a monk, you've been there, seen this. People have lived together for such a long time. Such a long time, they cannot really define or think of themselves apart from their partner. And when that partner vanishes, it's such a, one of the hardest things in the world. Remember our neighbor, he also happens to be the mayor of the Serpentine Jagat Shah at the time. We got to be really good friends over many years. And I remember going to see him. Went to his wife's funeral and saw him afterwards just to check up he was okay. He was a neighbor. And he told me, just, you know, sometimes people say these things and it's not just ordinary speech. It's really coming from deep within them. And he looked at me with his very sad eyes and said, "It's so hard to be without your wife when you've lived so long together." You see that pain inside of him. And of course, you know, he died a short time afterwards. And I remember going to that funeral of Clem Kentish because his daughter, you know, took over the farm, Coralie, and she was a very tough girl because she was looking after the farm. And, you know, after the funerals, what happens? You go up and sort of give your condolences. And I said, all the condolences, anything I can do, sort of let me know. And then, you know, she tried to hug me. You know, which people do in Australia. I said, "No, you can't hug a monk." She said, "Yes, I can." And she was so fast. She was used to wrestling sheep to the ground and cows. I stood no chance. She got me. I'm sorry, because that's, you know, farmers' daughters, you know, be careful, monks and nuns. You got no chance at all. She wanted to, so she did. And that was a, you know, nice thing, because he was just showing her affection for being a friend of her mum and dad for such a long time. But I always remember that how painful it was that when the relationship actually does have to end. So you always must remember that. You know, if you have monogamy, it will never last forever. So how do you deal with that? And of course, the idea of things not lasting forever, you know, it's actually, when you get your head around it, it's actually quite beautiful. You know, you all know that story of concerts. It's not one concert which goes on forever. You know, it has even like Wagner's Rings. Like, how long does that go on for? The full one? For days sometimes. It's like a cricket match sometimes. But it always comes to an end. And you know you're listening to that music, knowing it's going to end. You go on a holiday, knowing it's going to end. You come to these talks, knowing it's going to end. But that doesn't stop you coming here. Because we change our idea of eternity and stability and permanence to something which is far more beautiful in my eyes. This coming together with another person, sharing your time together, maybe hours or days or months or many years or decades. You come together, and when you do go, you realize what a wonderful time we spent together. Thank you so much, darling. All the great moments we've had together, the difficult times as well. Raising children, all the struggles and problems. We've done so much together. Thank you so much. That was a great concert we have together. If you do that at the very beginning, knowing it's going to end, looking at relationships like a concert, it changes the ball game. And this is what my teacher, Ajahn Chah, used to say. He'd get up the cup simile. It's a beautiful simile, this. He'd get up a cup, he'd put it in front of us. The first time he did this, we always thought he was crazy. Because I never really got it until, you know, he started saying something I never expected and thought, wow, that's amazing. He said, "Can you see the crack in the cup?" Now, you know, can you see, Venerable Mudita, you're very close, can you see the crack in the cup? "No, you can't see. I can't see one either. But there's one there," Ajahn Chah would say. "There's a crack there, but it's microscopic. That's why you can't see it. One day, someone is going to drop this cup, or they're going to kick it over. It's going to fall against the wall or something, and then the crack which is already in here will open up, and this will break, and it won't be usable anymore. It is fragile. It is a crack of impermanence. The essential inherent fragility of glass." And he said, because it's got that crack, and always remember there's a crack in there somewhere, then you know you have to look after it. and care for it, because one day it will crack. The alternative, he argued, and it's a very beautiful argument, if this was a plastic cup, it would be unbreakable. You can throw it against the wall, you can play football with it, you can, an elephant can stomp on it. Maybe that's going a bit far, but it's almost unbreakable. Because it's unbreakable, you don't need to care for it. And he said, human beings have all got cracks in them. You are all cracked. One day that crack will open up. You know, heart attack, stroke, cancer. So many myriad ways you're going to die, but you're cracked. It will open up one day. That is why you care for your body. Relationships, they're cracked. From the time you meet together, the first flush of love is cracked. One day it will pass. Remember that. The number one, you really care for the relationship. It's important. You don't take it for granted. And when it does crack, I expected that. And we cared for it and we had so many wonderful glasses of water in this cup. Thank you so much, darling. Now, one of my relations died last Monday or Tuesday. Interesting guy. He was 90, an uncle. Interesting guy because he was married for 60 years to my auntie. And their marriage was something really interesting. Because this auntie, she grew up almost like was not really an auntie, it was a cousin of my mother, but they grew up like sisters. And they did everything together. And this was just after the Second World War. And with my mum and this girl, Opal, sisters, they went to go and see one of these mediums just for fun. You know, like people, I'll just see what happens. But it wasn't eventually that much fun. Actually, it was really scary because this medium looked at my auntie and said, "You are soon to meet your husband. And I'll tell you his name. His name will be Donald, surname Wolfries." That's pretty specific. And Wolfries is not a common name. And I'd asked them about this so many times. I couldn't believe this was impossible. And I said, what happened next? Well, a couple of weeks later, I was at one of these dances, which people did in those days to meet one another. You know, pretty tame by modern nightclub standards, but, you know, this guy came and asked her to dance, and she liked him. And, of course, you know, you ask each other's names. What's your name? Oh, my name's Opal. What's your name? Donald. What is your surname? Wolfries. And they were married over 60 years. He just died last week. She's still going strong. It's amazing. Just how can that really happen? There's some old karma there somewhere which people actually can pick up on. But eventually they have to part. But you know, they realize, glass, care for one another. Because one day it will break. When you know that, when you go into a relationship, then you don't get hurt so much when it breaks early, it breaks late. And you learn from every time it breaks late, look after the cup a bit better next time. And sometimes you just can't do anything about it. Like my auntie, she couldn't do anything about it. Donald Wolfries, okay, let's get married. Can't do much about that. But the nice thing is, because that's monogamy, now the polygamy, I mean, why do you want somebody else? That really hurts your partner. I don't know of anybody who would willingly really want, you know, the person they loved and cared for to, you know, to have sexual relationships with somebody else. It doesn't make much sense to me. I can't get my head around that. Maybe it can happen, but as long as, you know, it's done consensually, everybody is happy, they really are happy, okay. But I can't see that. But the other alternative is solitude. And that's the nice one, which for many, many years, you know, a man and a woman, you know, you had to get married. And, you know, if you weren't married as a woman, people thought there was something wrong with you. You know, even if you were gay, you know, that, you know, if you weren't gay, you weren't getting married, people thought there was something really wrong with you. Not getting married, not living with a partner, what's wrong? And because of that, there's a lot of social pressure, especially on women, to find a partner. And even today, there's many, many Asian girls come up to me and they say they're in big pressure from their parents over in Sri Lanka or Malaysia or Singapore or in Hong Kong or in China. Why aren't you married yet? And that puts such really terrible pressure on the person. Sometimes people just don't want to get married. And that is fine. Girls, you don't have to be married. You get just as much respect and happiness being single. And guys as well, to understand what I'm talking about, there is an old wonderful story which happened over in Bodhinyana many years ago when these two sisters came to me for counseling. And so they came together, Thai girls, and her elder sister, what's your problem? And her problem was her marriage. She'd married an Australian guy and having a very, very difficult time together. And so, you know, I gave her some ideas and some strategies to try and get her marriage back on track. She was having a lot of suffering in her marriage. And once I dealt with her, a younger sister, what's your problem? And I always remember she said, look, I was really looking for a husband and someone to share my life with. I go out with a guy, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and it falls apart. I've been doing this for the last couple of years. I can't sustain a relationship, and it's driving me crazy. And that's what she said. And then I looked at both of them, and I said, I got the solution. And I said, the older sister, you've got a husband you don't want. Younger sister, you want a husband. I said this. I love playing around with people. It's obvious, swap. Why not your sisters? You share things. And they wouldn't have a word bar of it. They said, no, we can't do that. Why not? After laughing, then I told them the deeper part of it. I said, you, elder sister, you've got what we call relationship suffering. Husband suffering, wife suffering, having to live with another person. That's a particular type of suffering you've got. And you really think that once you get rid of your husband, you'll get rid of that suffering. Yeah, you will get rid of that type of suffering, but then you'll get what your sister has. Single woman suffering. Isn't it the case we think, if we could change this and get something else, then all our problems will be over? Have you ever tried that before? You know, having a difficulty in a relationship, okay, we're going to break up, then no more suffering. All you do is you change one form of suffering for another form of suffering. That's what welcome to the world is. And what somebody, people afterwards, they hear me say things like that, and say, okay, I got it. I won't be single, I won't be married, I'll become a monk or a nun. And they think, monks or nun, nice and peaceful, free, living in monasteries, meditating all day. Yeah, it's true, you don't have marriage suffering. You don't have looking for a partner suffering. You have monk suffering. And I remember that as a young monk. Monk suffering. When I became a young monk, I had young monk suffering. What young monk suffering was, you know, when all these big senior monks, they decided all the projects and I had to work hard all day doing those projects. When the food came, they got all the best food. And I just got what was left over. And I thought, all those senior monks, they're all enlightened beings. They don't need the delicious food. I'm just trying. I've got a lot of my defilements and cravings. I need the nice food. They don't even appreciate it. They're all arahats, fully enlightened. What do they need the nice food for? I should have the nice food. And also, look at them. They're all fat. They don't need so much food. I was really thin in those days. And also, the more senior you are, the more cushions you have. They had so many cushions, and I had to sit on the bare concrete because I was really junior. And I had no flesh on me at all. I was all bones. I should have all those big cushions. They've got their own cushions. They're fat. And that was called junior monk suffering. Now I'm senior monk. Now I've got senior monks suffering. All those junior monks, they don't have to come and talk to people about their marriage problems, financial problems, children problems. After the meal, I have to sit there for hours talking to people. I became a monk to get away from all of that, and they just go off and just have a nice time. They don't need to go and give talks. They don't need to do all this sort of stuff. Oh, they're just so lucky. So now I have senior monk suffering. Now you can understand polygamy, monogamy, solitude. Sometimes you're just changing one form of suffering for another. So you change your job. You change your job being a teacher to being a businessman, working for others or working for yourself. Many of you try that. If you work for others, you get the working for others suffering. So you say, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to be free to be my own boss. And then you've got being your own boss suffering. So you don't escape in this world. So instead, what you need to do is actually to learn whatever you've got, make it work. So if you are a young monk, enjoy it. When you're an old monk, enjoy it. And if you're single, enjoy being single. It's got many advantages to it. Which is why talking about solitude, why not? It's a great way of living. Being solitude, you can get up whenever you want, and no one's going to push you. You have the whole bed to yourself, not a part of it. You have a good night's sleep without having to listen to somebody snoring. No arguments, you can just whatever you like, whenever you want to do it. But why is it that some people find it so hard to be by themselves? Number one is because you think, I shouldn't be by myself. There's something wrong with me. No, there's nothing wrong with you. It's okay to be by yourself. And it's allowed to be single if you want to be single. And it's not stigmatized. You used to say like an old maid, on the shelf. Something wrong with you. You've lost. No one wants to buy you. There must be some defect in you. There's no defect in you. If you want to be single, go for it. If you want to be gay, go for it. Whatever you want to do, for goodness sake, it's not what you do, but how you do it. So how can you be single and have a wonderful life? Not monogamy, but I suppose what you call it, one-ogamy. Just yourself instead of, that's actually monogamy, isn't it? Anyway, solitude, being by yourself. However, why haven't we got a name for that? Polygamy, well, not polygamy, polygon, I don't know. So monogamy or being single. Why haven't we got a word for that? Because for many years it hasn't been respected. And sometimes people ask me, because this is where I have my expertise, being alone. And you all know that part of my monastic life, I managed to get 6 months of solitude. Well, I never saw a human being for 6 whole months, let alone speak to anybody, in a nice monastery down in Bodhinyana in Serpentine. The monks protected me. They just left food in a box and I got it afterwards. Never spoke to any human being for 6 whole months. And I know, because when I came out afterwards, people told me they couldn't wait to see what I'd be like when I came out. The odds were that I'd be crazy, big wide eyes, and totally off the planet. And I think many people were disappointed that I wasn't, in one sense. But how can you live for 6 months with no contact with any human being? No TVs, no radios, no internet, just me. And the reason was because I knew a long time ago, for solitude, you're never alone. This is a great little story for your kids if you want to tell them something. And this was a story of an Indian story of a teacher many, many years ago in India. In those days, they'd have just a number of disciples. And they'd teach the number of disciples everything. For writing and arithmetic, astronomy, ethics, the whole works. And this particular teacher had a gorgeous daughter. She was really hot. And all the students, wanted to sort of marry her. They can't go out with her. And in those days, it had to be the father who decided. And according to the customs of those days, the father had to marry her daughter to one of his students. And a day came when he brought all of his students together and told them, it's time for my daughter to marry one of you. And I can't find out, I can't decide which one I shall choose. So, I'm going to give you a test. And whoever wins this contest will be able to marry my beautiful daughter. And there's also, I have another problem, said the teacher. I'm really poor. And when you get married, it costs a lot of money. Even these days, it costs a fortune to get married. Now you have to hire this big house, this big sort of, what is it, reception areas, reception rooms. You have to hire them for a year in advance. They're all the clothes, you know, the dresses, the rings and the presents and the holidays. Wedding costs fortunes. You don't need to do that, for goodness sake. Dennis and I, we do it for pretty cheap. I don't get anything, but I know what Dennis gets, but it's not that much. You don't need to have a wedding dress. Just come in some old jeans or something. That's good enough. But people spend so much. But anyway, he said it's going to cost a lot of money and I can't really afford it. So I've decided not how to kill two birds with one stone, because that's not Buddhist. How to cut two carrots with the same knife. I always make up these new similes from old ones. So to cut two carrots with the same knife, for me to be able to choose and get some money for both of you, I want you to go into the village at night time and steal whatever you can from the houses in the village. And whoever steals the most will get my daughter, and all of the proceeds will be given to the happy couple. And the students were really surprised. To steal? He said, yeah, that's the only way you can get my daughter, but you have to make sure, don't let anyone see you stealing. Okay? I said, okay. So all these students, now they were obedient, not like these days in our schools in Australia. If your teacher said something in those days, you would do it, especially, you know, a nice daughter to marry afterwards if you got the most. So they'd all creep into the village at night time. They wait till people were out from their houses or when they were fast asleep, and they would creep into the houses very softly, and they would pinch this and take that, and then they would go back to the teacher with all they'd stolen. And the teacher would ask them, from what house? And he made a very, very, very clear description of where they came from, how much it worth, and who stole it, because he had to decide who was going to marry his daughter. And at the end of 1 week, he called all the students together and said, you've stolen enough already, so I don't need you to go in any longer. And I want to announce the winner of the contest. And everyone was very excited. Who's going to get the daughter? But before he announced who stole the most, he said, you've all stole a lot except for one of you who haven't stolen anything. Why? You've been disobedient? And this poor young man came up and said, no, master, no teacher. I was obedient. Did you go to the village? Yeah, I went into the village at night time. Did you creep into the houses? Yeah, I crept into the houses. Did you try and steal something? I did, but I remembered your instructions not to steal if somebody was watching. I said, well, there's nobody in the house. Who was watching? I was watching. I was watching me steal, said the student. That's why I could take nothing. Other people aren't watching you, but you are watching you. And then the master said, sadhu, 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 thank goodness I've got one student who's wise, who's been listening to me, paying attention over after all these years. Now, he said to all the other students, take all the stuff back. The villagers were expecting you. They were in on this test. They won't give you to the police or beat you or shout at you. Give it all back. You know where it came from. I'm already far rich enough. And now I give the hand of my daughter to the only wise student I've got. And the two of them live happily ever after, because he knew, even though his wife wasn't watching, he was watching. He was watching what he did. The mindfulness, the self-awareness, the conscience. So when I was 6 months, I wasn't alone. There was always somebody watching me. There was always somebody listening to me. You know who that was? Me. I was never alone. In fact, for those 6 months, I was with my best friend. Me. Because I am my best friend. And from that day on, I realized that anyone who's lonely or depressed being by themselves. The reason is they don't have a good relationship with themselves. Literally, they don't love themselves. If you learn how to love yourself and be your own best friend and be totally happy in your own skin, in your own company, then you know the secret of blissful solitude, but also the fact when you're with somebody else, you're happy with other people as well. Now, after all that time, you see just how I can connect with you guys. I connect with myself. As I treat myself, I treat you. And this is how you can live in solitude, monogamy or by yourself, as long as you are your own best friend. And how do you become your own best friend? So simple to do. I remember the first teaching I got from my first meditation teacher. Really profound. Those sort of deep teachings, which, you know, sometimes you read in a book and say, wow, that shows you the meaning of life. This was one of those really deep, profound teachings which you are very, very fortunate to hear. How to live with yourself. He said, when you get up in the morning, do you go to the toilet? Yeah, go to the toilet. Go in the bathroom, he said, even before you have a urinate, look at your face in the mirror. And I said, at the time I was a student, and I said, I'm a student, I stay up late at night. Most days I was drinking. I wouldn't like to even glance at myself in the mirror. I'd be scared of what I see. Because, you know, when you get up first thing in the morning, you don't really look your best. By a long shot. And he said, look at yourself in the mirror, follow my instructions, and smile. I said, oh, come on, impossible. I mean, maybe after a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, when you wake up, then you can start smiling. He said, no. Smile. If you can't do one naturally, he said, get your two fingers and push up. And I did that for 2 years, never missing a morning. As a student, maybe 18, 19 to about 21, I went to the bathroom every morning, looked at myself in the mirror and made a face. And I saw this stupid young man in the mirror. And naturally, I started smiling. The guy in the mirror started smiling. I smiled even more. Every morning, I laughed at myself for two and a half years. It's stuck now. I can't get it down again. It's up here. Now, honestly, that is... Now, people say, okay, we need some philosophy, some deep teachings about the meaning of life, dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, about emptiness and interdependence, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that sounds good, but this works. So, that is how you can love yourself, by smiling yourself in the mirror. Isn't that how people express their love to you? You know, when you go and see your mum or your grandma or something, or your lover, and they're just so happy in your presence, they smile. Oh, it's you again. Not really nice to see you. Thank you, darling. Even if, you know, your lover gives you a hug. If you're by yourself, I developed this as well. Now, can you all follow my instructions? Put your hands out, please. Hands out, come on. Follow my instructions. And if you've got Ebola or some other disease and no one likes you, put your hands out like this and follow me. That's it. Really get into it. Isn't that nice? So if no one else would do that, you'd do it to yourself. It doesn't matter, you know, if you've got a disease, you can't catch your own diseases. And no one's going to sort of, you know, take you to, you know, the children's abuse, what's it called, that thing they're doing over in the East. Hug somebody else, you get into trouble these days. Hug yourself, you never sue yourself for hugging yourself, so you're perfectly safe legally, health-wise, and you're learning how to love yourself. A simple thing like that. Which means that you like yourself, are at peace with yourself, so... solitude is an option for you. So what it does mean is, yeah, you can have a beautiful relationship with another person, and if it does crack, falls apart, doesn't matter, you've got yourself. And because you love yourself, you can love another. Because you can love another, you can love yourself. It means you're never lonely when the love of your life passes away. You're never desperate for somebody else's company. You have your own. So monogamy, solitude, both, you know how to love. Which means it's always peaceful, it's always happy, it's always really fulfilling. So it takes away the fear of a breakup. And that is one of the problems why relationships do break up. Because you're afraid of them breaking up. You think they have to stay together because if I lose this partner, I won't be able to live. If you know how to live by yourself because you love yourself, then you don't break up these relationships out of fear, out of clinging, out of desperate need to have that person in your life. And then your life, it's wonderful. Really enjoy your company, darling. It's just, oh, we have such wonderful times together. We got to know each other so well. But if they're not there, you're still happy. Which means a desperate yearning, which often breaks up and smothers relationships, is not there anymore. If you know how to be in solitude, you know how to have monogamy, good relationships. If you know how to have good relationships, real good relationships, you know how to be by yourself. There's no difference. There's always someone watching you, being with you. You, your partner, what's the difference? I say, no difference. So, doesn't matter. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So, any questions from the internet? It's always a bit scary. You don't know what questions you're going to get. And where are you going to get them from either? So this could be anywhere in the world. Today we have from Hungary, Iceland and Germany. Iceland, oh, it's in June now, so it should be not so cold over there. So you see how far these talks go to Iceland and Hungary and Germany. Ajahn, almost no animals are monogamous. Why do we allow conditioning in recent history to make us believe in unnatural marital law? I don't know if that's actually true, because I know parrots are monogamous. So I always remember, just at the bottom of our monastery, Kingsbury Drive, where it meets the Southwest Highway, a parrot got hit by a truck, and it was dead. And another parrot was sitting on a branch, looking down. And it didn't move for 3 days, because we went up and down. The parrot was still there. Didn't move for 3 days. It's obviously that, you know, what that meant. That was grief. Because parrots actually mate for life. And so, I'm obviously assuming things. I didn't interview the parrot. But, to me, it's pretty obvious that was grief happening. And I don't know if you also know why. Actually, they found this out in an article in the Northern Territory. That just, all the birds which get, that's right, there are no birds which get hit by, no, the crows, I think the crows only, which don't get hit by cars. They only get killed by trucks. You know, they're on the roadkill. And they couldn't figure this out, so I think one university group of students was sent out to the Northern Territory on these long stretches of road. Why is it there's no crows killed by cars, only the trucks? And they found out that whenever a crow goes onto the road to actually eat roadkill, its friend, its mate, stands on a tree to warn them. And the lookout, they can always say, car, car. They don't know how to say truck. Okay, did I get you there? That's a terrible joke for today. So, there are many animals which are monogamous. They mate for life. So that's all I know anyway. From Iceland. So make us believe in unnatural marital law. Let's see, what is natural marital law? Because a lot of times being celibate, people used to say that's unnatural. Being gay, people would say that was unnatural. Even 10, 20, 30 years ago, they would say that. What is unnatural? And sometimes it's what our society impresses on us. And then a lot of times that causes a huge amount of problems when we know who we are and the society doesn't allow it to happen. So, yeah, I mean, sort of, for years I really felt for the gay community. You know, that's who they are. And society says, no, it's unnatural, that is unacceptable. But even now I've heard people say that being celibate is unnatural. And I actually feel what the gay people felt, that we are unnatural, we're weird. But actually, I quite like being weird. I'm really into weirdness anyway. So, unnatural marital law, the law is the problem a lot of times, and the law comes from society, and society needs to sort of expand its awareness a little bit. So, monogamous, polygamous, solitude. As I said at the beginning, it's the way you do it is most important. Are you doing it kindly, compassionately, wisely? Is it selfish? Is it not really being concerned with another person and how they feel? If it's all about yourself, then that is not moral. If it is really for the betterment of others, okay, fine. Anyway, from Iceland, renunciation of monogamy seems why men hesitate with wedding vows. Is it unwise to marry young before we are wise enough to make the right decision? That's a good question from Iceland. To marry young so you're stuck before you know what you're really doing. That is obviously not a good idea. I mentioned last week, for monks, we can leave at any time, because our vows are not life vows. That is a problem. When we make a vow when we're very young, and we have, there's no way out for the rest of our life. That's like being in a prison. So it's much, and obviously, being in a monastery, I'd rather have monks who want to be there, who are happy being there, to see the benefit of being there, rather than just have to be there because of some decision they made 10, 20, 30 years ago. That must be so terrible. And that's why sometimes I feel for Catholic priests. They make a decision when they're young, and they can't get out. Now, Buddhism, at least you can get out any time as a monk. If you're not having, or as a nun, if you don't like it, you feel, no, it's not really for me, or you change your mind, you can leave. So you're only here because you want to be here. In a marriage, the same, because sometimes in a marriage relationship, it does feel like you're in a prison. You can't leave. It's good not to leave easily. No, that's why a monk comes up and says they want to leave. I don't say, okay, off you go. No, you're trying to find out what the problem is, see if they can work through it. They're maybe just going through a bad patch or whatever. In a relationship, you don't just leave straight away, not so easily. See if you can work it through, talk to one another, see if you can find a solution somehow or other. Because I know from experience, people have actually worked it through. Oh, they have such great relationships when they've been through problems. They stick together, they work it out. Wow, they really get close together then. So, it is sometimes to try and work things through. But if it doesn't work, there comes a time to say, well, look, it's not really helping anybody, so it's time to leave. And when it does leave, of course, no recriminations, no anger, no guilt. It just happens. Cup is cracked. It's come to the end of its life. But men hesitate with wedding vows. Not all men. I've been to so many weddings because I bless them all. And sometimes it's a man who can't get the ring on his wife's finger fast enough, who cries and just... This is men who cry these days at weddings. It's beautiful to see. The times have changed. And men can express their emotions. And say, no, this is the God I want. I really want to do this fast. We've got time. Oh, going over time. I told this ghost story over in Melbourne. It's one of the most amazing ghost stories. The girl who married a ghost, remember that story? This is absolutely true. I think it was in Adelaide, but it could be in Melbourne because I can't remember now. Woman getting married. By tradition, she arrived 5 minutes late on purpose. When she got out of the car, the groom hadn't arrived. So she too thought that the man had got cold feet, just was scared off, wasn't going to get married. She was really concerned. So she waited around 5, 10, 15 minutes. She didn't know whether he just stood her up or whether he had some sort of accident. And she soon found out it was the second thing. He had an accident because she saw him running down the street towards her. And his wedding suit was all dirty and just he had blood on it and on his bruises and cuts on his face. But he ran towards her and he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, darling, I'm late. Car accident." And she took one look at him and said, "I'm taking him to the hospital." He said, "No, no, no. I want to go through with the wedding." just I'll go to the men's room, just wash myself, clean myself up, we're going to do it. And that's what he did. Wash himself up, clean himself up as best as possible. And they went through the whole wedding with the vows, exchanging rings, you know, the kisses, the signing the marriage register. And after that was all over with the photographs with all the family, as usual. Then the two of them got in their own car because they wanted time by themselves while they went to the reception with all the guests, family and friends following behind in their cars. And because he was still a bit shaky after the accident, she decided she would drive. He was sitting in the passenger seat. And then the cars coming behind saw the front car with the bride and groom parked by the side of the road. And with her outside the car screaming hysterically. And no sign of the groom. No sign at all. And when they asked her what had happened, she said she was driving along talking to him. And at this spot, he vanished. He disappeared into thin air. When they found out afterwards, that was the spot that he had died about an hour or two before. It was a girl who married a ghost. He died, but he wanted to get married so much. This is how I know it happens. He managed his mind, made a body, took it to the church, kissed, exchanged rings, signed registers, everything, and then died, or vanished rather, he's already dead. The girl who married a ghost. Is that romantic or freaky? It's a bit of both, really. Great story, though. Anyway, I don't know what that's got to do with the question from Iceland, but it's a nice story. And from Germany, I am struggling with letting go and have been trying to get detached from people who are not good to me anymore, good for me anymore. My heart does not follow what my mind wants. How can I put this into practice? If you start cultivating the heart rather than the thoughts, like I try to encourage people to do, to meditate more, to feel meditation, feel your life, and don't think too much about it. If you think too much about it, that's where you really get your cultural ideas coming through. This is what I should do, it's what I shouldn't do, it's what my parents want me to do, it's what I was told I should do. And those ideas, they really screw people up. So you feel it. Yeah, my heart does not follow what my mind wants. That's not the point. The mind should follow what your heart wants. So you say, your heart does not follow what my mind wants. Put it the other way around. Let the mind follow the heart, not the heart follow the mind. Don't think about it. Feel it. And detached from people are not good to me. If they're not good to you anymore, feel that. You know, the feeling inside of you from Germany is you really want to let go of these people. So follow the feeling. Don't start to arguing and getting... Because the mind is sometimes like these lawyers. These lawyers, they can argue anything. And sometimes have this lawyer inside the mind. Oh, just, you know, you should stay with him. Work it out. It'll be okay. You should stay with him. Don't follow the thoughts. Follow the heart. What do you feel? If you feel they're not good for you, it's quite honestly, the heart should win. And just let it go. Okay, and I should let you go because I've gone over time. Yet again, I do apologize for going over time, but there's no extra charge for the overtime because I don't belong to a union. So thank you all for coming. And please don't forget your tickets for the greatest global conference on Buddhism. That's the greatest conference on Buddhism. If you haven't got one yet, please go and buy one. If you have already got one, buy another one for some poor person. It's a great charity. And that's our conference in August. And it actually follows my birthday, having the birthday the day before August the 7th. And the conference is on August the 8th or 9th. So if you want to give me a birthday present, buy a ticket and come. Thank you very much. Let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava. Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.